I found that if a parent works with a speech and language pathologist, depending upon how the sessions are coded, medical insurance will pay for it. Is that true?
That is 100% true. Sometimes you can find to where insurance will cover literacy-based therapy. Generally, if the goals are written by the SLP in an academic way, they're not going to be covered. But if the goals are written in a way to address the underlying language deficit of what they're trying to address, then some insurance companies will cover that.
Hello, and welcome to the Black and Dyslexic Podcast with Winifred A. Winston and LaDerek Horn, the show that unapologetically focuses on helping Black and underrepresented minorities navigate the special education process. We want to help raise awareness in the Black and Brown community, remove the stigma about learning disabilities, and provide you access to professionals in the space of dyslexia and special education that you need to hear from.
Today, we have Sydney Bassard with us. She is a speech and language pathologist. I'm super excited because Sydney is from North Carolina. Yay, North Carolina. You know, Petey Pablo been on my mind today. I listened to Steve Harvey on the Earn Your Leisure podcast. And so he was giving Petey Pablo much love. So I'm excited because y'all know I have North Carolina roots. Again, Sydney is a speech and language pathologist. And we just want to get in and get to know Sydney and the work that she's doing. So welcome to the Black and Dyslexic podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Great you're here.
So Sydney, tell me, I know you're a speech and language pathologist and that encompasses working with different learning disabilities and folks who have different challenges, but how did you get in the space of working with those who have dyslexia?
Thanks. Okay, so that is a long story in which I'm going to condense. So around 7 years ago, I just got a notification on Facebook that it's been 7 years. My brother actually got diagnosed with dyslexia and ADHD, and he was in the sixth grade when that happened. So pretty late, considering that we know we can diagnose dyslexia much earlier. And so I was kind of in a crossroads in my own life. I was a sophomore in college. And I originally thought I wanted to be a pharmacist, but that was just not going how I wanted to. Organic chemistry is a beast, and I was not prepared for that one. So I didn't know what I wanted to do, but the learning center that he went and got reading instruction help at was actually hiring for the summer. And my mom was very nice, but said, you need to do something. And it's okay that you don't know what you want to do, but you need to figure out something and work somewhere this summer. So they hired me. And that's how I got involved really with dyslexia, dyslexic intervention. I worked there throughout the summer. I really loved working at that center. And I knew that I didn't want to necessarily do that all the time. I wanted some more freedom and autonomy to kind of do what I wanted to do and practice more holistically. And so then I decided that I was going to get my master's and become a speech language pathologist. And so 7 years later, this is kind of where I'm at.
Oh, wow. Wow. So how did they train you that summer at that learning center?
So I worked at Linda Mood Bell Learning Processes. So I got explicit training in their primary programs of the seeing stars and the visualizing and verbalizing. But I learned a lot about the cognitive part of reading and how, like, it's not just important, you know, to have kids do multi-sensory instruction, but to really tap into the brain and to find out, like, the understandings and the underworkings of cognition and regards to reading instruction. So it was probably one of the best things that I could have ever done for my career.
Yeah, their hiring process is very intense as well, right? That's the first intervention we had here in Maryland. We did Linda Mood Bell, and the hiring process, they make you do some type of test or something with, like, the sounds or whatever. Like, it's really intense. Like, you have to know your stuff. And I know a lot of people who went through it and was like, oh my gosh, I didn't do well, or I didn't make it. Like, I thought I knew X, Y, and Z. So they do a really good job of screening folks and then training you. So that's huge. So I know you work with kiddos with dyslexia, but tell us a little bit about others that you work with as well.
Yeah, so I'm really excited. I actually opened my own private practice in February of this year. And so previously I worked in an outpatient pediatric hospital in Virginia Beach area, and I specialize in two areas. So dyslexia and reading disorders is one, and then working with children with hearing loss that use cochlear implants or hearing aids, some type of amplification, is the other area that like are my two big areas that I work with. So in my practice is really tailored around those two things. Research has shown that children with hearing loss, especially those that use some type of amplification, tend to have difficulties with phonological awareness and then later reading challenges as well. And then we know that children with dyslexia have difficulties with phonological awareness and really need that direct explicit instruction. So it's nice because I get to merge my two specialty areas and passion under one umbrella in my business.
Wow. And preparing for this conversation, I did a little research on you. And I was reflecting on the first time that I ever interacted with a speech and language pathologist, and beyond just like maybe at a conference or what have you, but my father had a stroke and was having a hard time swallowing. And I know this isn't your area of expertise, but I was surprised because I guess it was his doctor or whatever said to help him with the swallowing, he needed a speech and language pathologist. That was something that they would do. But specifically, like if I was a parent, how would I know like a speech and language pathologist is like the person I need to talk to be able to support my child who might be struggling with dyslexia? Like what would be like some of the signs of that? Or, you know, how would you be able to help them?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And I think it's important to note that depending on the setting, your SLP may not be able to help you. And so SLP is short for speech language pathologist, but they may not be able to help you. Generally in the school setting, most SLPs are, they're neither not trained necessarily in how to do literacy-based instruction, or if they do have any knowledge of it, the schools kind of put like shackles on them, for lack of a better word, and tell them that's not your area. You don't do that. You don't really address those things. And so as a professional, like they may not be able to help you. I think that's where specialty clinics or people that specialize really can come in more into play. And so what I tell parents is look for people that don't just know a program or an approach. Oftentimes, and I'm on the Facebook groups too, you know, parents are very much so looking for someone that knows this one program or this one way. The beautiful thing about if you can find an SLP that knows about literacy-based instruction is you can find somebody that is holistic in their treatment. They're not just trained in the one way, but they really understand language and the underpinnings and how dyslexia is, it's a language-based disorder. So how are the things that we are working on with a child who's struggling with reading? What language skills are they associated with? And then generally what we also tend to find is sometimes these kids also have difficulty with comprehension, receptive language skills, speech sound disorder. So you're not just able to address the one thing of reading, but you're able to tie in the articulation. You're able to tie in those language. You're able to tie in social communication difficulties a child has. So you're really kind of tackling all of those things that are really important for a child to be able to function in their environment instead of just like the one thing that a parent might be thinking about in the moment, which is getting their child to read closer to grade level.
Yeah, my daughter's first tutor in school, when we were at a private dyslexia school, she was trained as a speech and language pathologist, as well as the literacy component. And just some of the tools and resources that she would tell me, like, hey, mom, you can do this at home, or have her do X, Y, and Z. And the way she explained things because of her training, I'm like, wait a minute, I think I'm onto something here. So Clubhouse, the audio platform Clubhouse, allowed me to connect and find SLPs who were trained. And so the nonprofit that we run, Dyslexia Advocation, you know, we serve as a referral network source for providers. And so that's one area that I was trying to find SLPs who were trained in some type of Orton-Gillingham approach, right? Who combined the literacy because of everything you just said. Now, I couldn't say it the way you just said it, but I knew I was onto something because that particular tutor worked really well with my daughter. She worked really yeah. well with her. Mm-hmm.
And we're out there. Like we are out there, I think, for SLPs and sometimes for parents, you know, if they're working with an SLP, the mind frame is like you work on speech sounds or you work with language and that's not what I need. Like my kid doesn't need that. Like we need the reading. And it's like, no, this is all tied together in a bow. And where we see that bow really come together is with reading comprehension. And so working with people to understand the full scope of what an SLP can do, because like Ladarius said, his first encounter was with somebody working with stroke and swallowing. That's also part of our field. You know, our field is very broad, a little maybe too huge sometimes. And so it does get a little confusing as to what we can and cannot do, but that's great. I love to see more SLPs working with literacy.
So the largeness of the field and even the name, right? Speech and language pathologist, like it's not tutor, right? I could imagine a parent kind of getting a referral and maybe wanting to pull back, particularly people of color, you know, like it sounds like, you know, who exactly would I be bringing into my child's life to help them? Can you talk about any of the kind of ways you work with families if there's, you know, any sort of fear about interacting and, you know, getting the supports that you could provide?
Yeah, I mean, there's always fear. Most times when I encounter families, they're like, but I don't want that. Like, I just want the tutor. And so what I always try to encourage families is tell them, like, the approaches that I'm using are not just going to help your kid in this one area. We're looking at big picture here. We're looking holistically. How is this going to benefit your child? And I, you know, I've had parents ask me, well, what's your success rate? Because sometimes when, you know, people are tutors, they talk about their success rates, about moving kids' grade levels. One thing that I always drill and instill with my families is I don't look at success on this global scale because I'm one person. So I'm not sitting here going, well, my success rate is XYZ. Now, what my success rate is your child able to functionally perform within their environment? Are they able to read the material that they need to on their grade level and comprehend it? For some kids, that progress moves quicker. For some, it might take a couple of years, but that doesn't mean that they weren't successful. What it means is it just is taking them longer, but they're successful now because they're able to, you know, say they were struggling with their letter sound association. They're successful because they're able to quickly automatically tell me those things. They're successful because they're decoding those words that they weren't able to decode before. They're successful because they're able to communicate with us in complete sentences that display that they have a thought organization that other people can follow along with as they are communicating. So sometimes, you know, it takes a little bit of time to develop those relationships of trust, but I am a firm advocate and believer in, I work with families. I don't work in a sense of like, I am doing my thing and you kind of step to the side. This is a partnership. This is a relationship. So if there is something that we're seeing that's not working or we need to make an adjustment, we have those conversations. And I think when parents hear that this is not a, I'm taking over and driving the boat, but really we are co-captains in this and we are both steering this thing to a place to get it to where it's floating beautifully on the water, it helps ease some of that tension that might be there initially.
Yeah, I was going to say with the training at Linda Mouvel, that was the first time that I saw that online tutoring worked. And before the pandemic, I was trying to get parents on board with online tutoring and they just weren't. They were like, oh, we need face-to-face. My kiddo is ADHD. You know, they're not going to sit still. And my daughter is ADHD as well. And at the time, I didn't believe it. I was one of those parents. Oh, we're Black. It's a medical code. They just want to slap that on her. But I was able to, I don't know if they did this in your center, but we would come in and observe so she wouldn't know that we were looking. And so we're watching her on the computer engaged and they're taking breaks and they're making it fun. Now for me, I was kind of like old school, sit there and just be still and do the tutoring, but no, she was down on the floor. She was up and she was just immersed in it and it was online. So can you speak to some of the benefits with the online tutoring? Because a lot of parents, since the pandemic, they've gotten on board with online, but you know, some do prefer, and some, of course, some kiddos do much better in person. But can you talk to some of the advantages of doing the tutoring online?
Yeah, so many advantages. So my practice is primarily teletherapy. So I see kids in North Carolina, because that's where I live and am based at, but I also see kids in Virginia, and I have a license in South Carolina as well. And it is so much more beneficial sometimes in a sense than in person, because what you're able to do as a practitioner is see what is in their environment. And so it helps you to pull things from within their environment to help them be motivated to learn. Sometimes I've had kids do, you know, we do scavenger hunts. Okay, I want you to go find this item, this item, this item. And that's how we might take a break. Or we're using that and we're practicing our sounds, or we're using that and saying, like, see if you can find this item in your house. And then we use those to talk about, like, okay, how do we spell this word? What sounds do we hear in this word? What if we switch this to this? What object would that be? Okay, go find it. And so it's making learning engaging and fun and interactive. I 100% hear what you're saying whenever, when you talk about, like, the sit down and just sit there and do it. And unfortunately, like, that was my experience prior to working at Linda Moot Bell. My parents are very old school. That was what their expectation was. And then I think even too, a lot of SLPs initially are trained in that mindset. It's the old educational mindset, like children need to comply and sit, and that is how they learn best. Does there need to be some self-regulation in there? Absolutely. Not saying that, you know, we can always be off the walls doing whatever we need to learn, but does it have to be so rigid? It doesn't. You can learn sitting under a table. You can learn looking out the window, drawing and writing with a dry erase on the window. You can learn so many different ways. We have to engage the mind. And if the mind is not engaged sitting there in a chair, that's okay. How else can we be flexible to engage the mind? Because ultimately what you do notice too is over time, as kids become more self-regulated, they are involving their mind and those executive functioning skills start working a little bit more. They end up coming back to the chair. It may not be for long periods of time, but they're able to sit down and do table work. So working with people is a huge benefit and skill that a lot of practitioners have, and some need to develop a little bit more.
Do you just work with kids, or would you take a 40-something-year-old man as a client? Because every time we do, I love this podcast. Every time we meet somebody new, I'm like, man, I could use some of that. What's the range of clients, the people you work with?
So I actually do work with adults too.
Okay.
So I work with primarily my practice is kids, but I work with adults with hearing loss that need some, we call it oral rehabilitation. And then I work with adults that are dyslexic, and that looks different too. I actually really like working with adults because it's a little bit more functional. Like, we can talk about job applications. We can talk about health literacy, you know, in regards to medical paperwork that has to be filled out. I mean, there's so many things with adults that I like really let them drive the session. What are you struggling with? And then how can we help you? People would be amazed. Like, people in executive positions need assistance with comprehending different paperwork. People that want to get into law school have, like, I've seen people all over the gamut, and they just need different things in order to be functional and successful in their life.
Is there, like, emotional work that you have to do? I could imagine both for, you know, young people, but also for adults. I know that many dyslexics, you know, we will just beat ourselves up. We're wrestling with issues around, you know, self-esteem, and that can even just be a barrier for us to reach out and get support. You know, I'm curious how much of the work you do is also sort of, you know, like motivating them and giving them the energy that they need to be able to take part in the support you're providing.
Yeah. So I think that is, counseling is a piece of being a provider, no matter what kind of a provider you are. And it does take that emotional work. I think there's also the recognition, there's a lot of shame sometimes that can be had, especially when people have dyslexia or any type of reading disorder, because a lot of things as we get older are just put in print. You know, you don't have people reading it to you, or it's not in an audio form. It's just, you're supposed to be able to read this. So here you go, fill it out, or here you go, read this. So working with people to understand that every person on this earth is dealing with some type of challenge. Some people's are visible and physical. Some people are, you know, mental, or within the person you can't see them. But every single person is dealing with something. So you're not alone in what you're dealing with. And then helping people to find compensatory strategies. So using technology, like, you know, people are like, well, I'm ashamed of this. Listen, Alexa exists for a reason. Google exists for a reason. I mean, sometimes I use Alexa or I use speech to text because I'm like, yeah, I know this word, but I have no idea how to spell this. Let's see if Alexa can tell me. And she does. She will spell it for you. So helping people to realize, like, okay, you're having difficulty. There's ways we can help you with this. But if you have a strategy, you have a tool, let's use it. You know, who cares that you don't know how to do XYZ? If there's something, a piece of technology that can do it for you, yeah, we're going to use that. Or totally going to use that. And don't feel judged by other people.
Sydney, can you talk about, you talked about when you're working with adults and the medical paperwork. I found that if a parent works with a speech and language pathologist, depending upon how the sessions are coded, medical insurance will pay for it. Is that true?
That is 100% true. So depending on, insurances are tricky. I'm not a fan of insurance companies because sometimes they will determine who should get the benefit of coverage via their insurance services or not. So that is just like my own personal thing. I'm not a fan of insurance companies for that. But sometimes you can find to where insurance will cover literacy-based therapy. Generally, if the goals are written by the SLP in an academic way, they're not going to be covered. But if the goals are written in a way to address the underlying language deficit of what they're trying to address, then some insurance companies will cover that. They also look at ICD-10 codes. So ICD-10 codes are how you classify what a child or an adult is working on. So there's a code for dyslexia. There's a code for mixed receptive expressive language disorder. There's a code for working on phonologic disorders. And so sometimes insurance companies will look at those codes as well and be like, okay, we approve X amount of sessions or we don't approve them. What I do in my practice, I'm 100% private pay, so I don't accept any insurances at all. But what I do is I offer families the benefit of a super bill. And so what that just means is I'm saying that I'm an out-of-network provider, but I am giving them a piece of paper to try to seek reimbursement from their insurance company. And why I encourage people to do that is because sometimes if an insurance company does say, hey, we're going to pay for this session, but the reimbursement rate is so low, the therapist might only see the kid for 30 minutes at a time, when really an appropriate recommendation might be like 1 to 2 or even 3 hours a week. They might only get 30 minutes here, 30 minutes there, because insurance is only willing to cover that. But if you see the person privately, yeah, out of pocket might cost you a little more, but you can get the reimbursement from the insurance. And then your kid is still getting the benefit of the appropriate like frequency and duration of session without being kind of slighted because your insurance company isn't willing to pay for that long.
Can you give us an idea, just sort of generally, you know, our podcast, people listen from all over the US, but what's a realistic range that someone should be paying for a SLP? Just so, you know, folks know that they're not getting ripped off.
Oh man, that's a tough question. I think it really depends on, I'm not going to give a price range because I think that really depends on geographic location and the skill level of the therapist that you're seeking. I will tell you, I've had parents come and tell me, they're like, well, I paid a tutor a lot cheaper than they were paying for my services for a longer amount of time. The saying is you get what you pay for. Mm-hmm. That's just true. So I think those questions that I kind of said at the beginning are being good ones to ask. Ask people, you know, maybe not years of experience, because sometimes people can have a lot of years of experience, but that doesn't mean that they fully understand what they're doing. So ask them, you know, what trainings have you been to? What is your educational or therapeutic philosophy? I think that that's an excellent question to ask, because any good therapist is going to have a methodology behind why they do the things they do. You know, ask them, are they trained in specific approaches or programs? And then how do they do therapy? Do they individually modify it based on the client, or do they just try to follow those same scope and sequence? Those tend to be better because some people are a little bit more costly than others, but that could also very well be dependent upon how much experience and expertise they're bringing to the table.
Yeah, we know that I've always talked about, I mean, it's a part of my pitch. I've said it multiple times that within a matter of 3 days, I was told I needed more than $22,000 to help my baby learn to read. And that included an independent educational evaluation, again, private pay, and then also the Linda Mubell summer program, right? And I say here in Maryland, it is anywhere from 75 to the tunes of 123 per session, right? Like that's a real number.
And you're recommended 4 hours at a time.
Oh yeah. Like we were doing 10 hours a week, 10 hours a week. She was doing 4 to 6. Like I was broke. Like we were broke. And we had to pay someone to pick her up from school and take her. So that's why I was so passionate about helping parents offset the cost of these services, because you're trying to pay for tutoring and folks are telling me get an attorney to fight, you know, to advocate for her. And it was just too much. But what you'll find is that some tutors aren't really trained, right? And so then they're trying to charge like these, I'm not going to name them, but these franchise places, you know, I've seen them online and I've asked, can you help someone with dyslexia? They'll give me all this roundabout way. They don't capture if the person has dyslexia or not. What? Then you can't help them then, because that don't make no sense to me. You're not doing an assessment to really determine where the issue is. Like, how do you set goals? So we know that the cost can range anywhere from 75 a session and up, you know, 55 a session and up. We know that. And so it can get very costly. And I tell parents no less than 2 sessions a week, like 3 would be great, but no less than 2 sessions, because you want to see progress and you don't want to have to have a child, you know, repeating everything they learned, you know. And some parents are like, well, something is better than nothing. No, sometimes that once a week, I had a parent, I think the person was doing 2 times a month, almost had like a heart attack or something. Like I couldn't believe it, because I'm like, that child is getting frustrated because every session they're going over the same thing again, because that's just ridiculous. So we know that there is definitely, there's a cost involved. And when we have funds available and when we get sponsorships, like right now we had someone sponsor an adult and a word analysis class. You talk about you working with adults. So we have an adult and Dr. Dyslexia Dude's course right now with 2 or 3 other high school students. And he's looking at the students and like, this one guy, he reminds me of me. I was him when I was in high school, you know, shy, not wanting to read aloud, do different things like that. And so we try to help offset the cost of tutoring services, advocacy, and the evaluations, right? Because we know that that's a hindrance for parents at any, you know, socioeconomic status, not just low income, because we didn't qualify for low income, but I sure couldn't afford LMB. I couldn't afford it. We made it happen, but I was broke.
Like, yeah, it's a sacrifice. I mean, it's a financial, and I think that that's kind of one of the reasons why I like private pay a little bit more than insurance. So by being private pay, like I 100% feel responsible every time that a parent's card gets charged, every time that I hit pay, like I feel that sense of responsibility. And not to say that people that take insurance don't, but it's a little bit different. You know, you're not necessarily sometimes seeing the direct payment because the insurance company pays for it. So you know, you do that and it comes to the provider. But when you know that you are like looking this parent in the face and every time you are taking their payment, you have a little bit of a weightier feeling as a provider. And then something that I tell parents about too is like, take breaks. I think sometimes people get so caught up in, they want their kid to succeed. They want to make the progress. They want to see, you know, the lights, bells and whistles go off. And that is 100% great. But kids are people too. Just like adults, when we're working, we take vacation, we take breaks. We, you know, we do things to kind of maintain that balance. Kids need that too. Yes, they need to work on things they're struggling with, but they also still need to be human. They need breaks. They need time to relax. They need time to be children. And so finding that nice balance, it kind of scares me sometimes when I hear people have been in OG tutoring for 4+ years and they're like, oh, we're making some progress. And it's like, well, you're not making a lot of, no, just a little bit, but they've been consistently going for 4+ years. It's like, oh man, maybe sometimes we need to give the brain a little bit of a break to breathe and to absorb the information that we've worked on. And then we can revisit this tutoring situation. But kids get tired. And sometimes we see like those fatigue effects hit when we don't allow breaks and the brain to grow and expand a little bit.
Sydney, you're talking to me because we're about on year 3, I think. And this is spring break, right? Right now we're in spring break. My daughter's on spring break. And her tutor said to me, so Logan's going to take off for spring break, right? And I was like, oh, she is? She said, yeah, she needs a little break. I said, okay. Like I was literally, you know, like, oh no, we're going to keep going. And so this summer I told her, we don't have to do the academic intervention with her school. I said, you can just go to camp because she really wants to play the guitar. And last summer, her guitar lessons were cut short because I was like, oh no, you're getting ready for middle school. I want to just make sure you don't forget anything. And I was that parent, right? So you're talking to me. I'm like, oh, she's talking to me. But we are on break right now. Like, she is taking a break. But you know, when you talked about private pay and insurance, it made me think about private dyslexia schools not taking what we call non-public placement because of what you said as far as duration and what type of interventions. So we know that each kiddo, you know, learns differently, and there may be some interventions and things that the private schools want to do that the IEP would not allow, right? And I've always said it, like, the private schools are not going to take non-pub funding, money from the state, to enforce the IEP because they know what works. They're the specialists and they've been teaching children with learning disabilities how to read. So no, we want to be private pay. So we have the flexibility to have the kiddo in, my daughter gets intervention 5 days a week. It's just built into her schedule. Whereas with the IEP, you know, they're dictating when, what, how, kind of similar. I never thought about it like that. But while you were speaking, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is the same reason why a lot of private schools don't want to take state money. Right? They want to do what they know how to do and the way they need to do it to move these children forward. So thank you for that. Because I was like, wait a minute, that makes sense. And I never thought about it in the sense of the sessions with a speech and language pathologist, right? I assume like if they're going to need 4 sessions, they're going to get 4 sessions. No. So that's very enlightening because that makes a huge difference. That makes a huge difference.
You had mentioned that you were like connected to different Facebook groups. If I'm trying to find a quality speech and language pathologist, where's a good place to look?
So that's a tough question. There are a couple of different websites I know that have gone up recently. SLP Find is one. And so that is just like a database of SLPs kind of all over the country. And so you can put in your zip code and information and people can find you there. There's another one that's escaping my mind right now, but they have like kind of databases in which they are trying to put together. Mom groups of your area tend to be okay. The only reason I say be careful with Facebook groups is you get a lot of people that will try to sell services and not necessarily be the person you're looking for. So that's one. And then two, there's a lot of censorship in them. So people sometimes are not allowed to post exactly what they want or need to say. Most SLPs that are in private practice of some sort have some type of social media page, whether it's Facebook, it's Instagram, some people even have TikTok. I mean, you can kind of get a little bit of more of an insight as to who your provider is and some of their thoughts before you even contact them. If you look on their public pages, because people generally are trying to share some type of free information with the public to kind of let people know, hey, like, I do know what I'm talking about, but it gives parents a little bit more of an insight as to who this person is.
Is there like a professional organization that SLPs would belong to, or that they would have membership in, or that it's industry standard, or it looks good if you're a part of a particular professional organization?
Yeah, 100%. So most SLPs are going to be a part of the American Speech Hearing Language Association, or ASHA for short. And if an SLP has been practicing most times for at least 9 months, after that time, you apply for something called your Clinical Certificate of Competence or Certificate of Clinical Competence, something like that. And we call it your CCC. So a lot of SLPs, once they've kind of passed that period, they'll have CCC-SLP behind their name. You can find people that way as well, but it doesn't really tell you a lot about their specialty. ASHA has it to where you can look to see if they are certified by them or not, but it doesn't necessarily give you a lot of information about the provider other than they live in this state and they have their CEs.
Is there a Black Association of SLPs?
There is. It is the National Black Association of Speech, Language, and Hearing, or NBASLA for short. And so they are like that kind of professional network for Black SLPs.
Sydney, as we close out, do you have one piece of advice that you'd like to share with families who are considering utilizing the services of a speech and language pathologist?
Yeah, I think, well, I guess it's kind of like two things. So one would be any money spent is an investment in your child and an investment in their future. And so sometimes there can be some sticker shock associated depending on the services, but just remember it's an investment, just like we invest in anything else in life. And then the second one would be, go ahead and feel comfortable with interviewing a little bit of the service provider you're seeking. Don't feel afraid to ask them questions and to really see if they're the best fit for your child, because every provider is not the best fit for every kid. And it is an investment. It is a role that you have as a parent to make sure that this person is going to do right by not only your child, but your family.
If folks would like to get in contact with you, what's the best way to do that?
So you can contact me by email at hello@thelisteningslp.com. Or you can find me on all social media platforms at The Listening SLP.
The Listening SLP. All right. I like it.
Tune in next week, where we'll continue to bring you lived experiences and more unfiltered conversations with experts in the field around all things Black and dyslexic. Make sure you subscribe and follow the Black and Dyslexic podcast, where we educate, empower, and equip Black and underrepresented minorities. The Black and Dyslexic podcast is partially funded by Morgan Cares and the Center for Urban Health Disparities Research and Innovation, awarded by the National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities. The Black and Dyslexic podcast is sponsored by Dyslexia Advocation Incorporated, a 501c3 charitable organization located in Baltimore City, Maryland, whose mission is to equip parents of children with dyslexia and other language-based learning disabilities with the necessary tools to help their children become successful readers. You can find them on the web at www.soallcanread.org.